But it's more important than that, because when you read The Lord of the Rings carefully, you realize, yes, the main characters are all male. But yet, the women are among the most important characters in the book, particularly Galadriel and everything she does, and Eowyn and everything she does. And then offstage, Arwen, Goldberry, Tom Bombadil's wife, and you could even add in Shelob, the giant evil female spider, but that might be pushing it too far. But the point is that in some ways, women drive the plot, even though that there are men doing the things in the plot, and women are extraordinarily powerful and represent certain different kinds of ideals. So I think it would be a mistake to go at Tolkien with the whole contemporary race, class, and gender view, though I think I've shown you in the past few lectures how that can be profitably applied. I think it's more important to look at how does The Lord of the Rings work as a fantasy? Does it work as a fantasy? And I would submit that it does, because it creates a powerful, beautifully realized secondary world that hangs together, that doesn't have to connect with our primary world because it stands on its own. Now, that said, Tolkien did try to build a little miniature frame narrative in the appendices that would connect The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and The Silmarillion to our primary world by suggesting that he was translating all of these from the Red Book of Westmarch, which was written by Bilbo and Frodo, added to by Sam, and the heirloom of Sam's house, and eventually comes down to Tolkien and he can translate this. It's an interesting idea, and it allows Tolkien to do more stuff with languages. But The Lord of the Rings avoids the technique of having our real world and then a secondary world that people travel to or look at. Tolkien suggests it's meant to be the distant past of our own world, but he doesn't push that very far, and I think there's a good reason. Because every time that you make the secondary world come into contact with the primary world, it weakens the illusion that you're really there. And if there's one thing that The Lord of the Rings has accomplished, more than its ideals of mercy, more than its ideals of the powerless becoming powerful, or the small doing the great deeds, it is that a secondary world can be so complete that people can enter into it. And people obviously do that with The Lord of the Rings all the time. It is, in fact, one of the driving forces for the writers who come afterwards, for those who felt that they wanted to invent their own secondary worlds after they'd engaged with Tolkien's. For generations of readers now, Middle-earth has been someplace that people have felt they've really gone. And the journey of The Lord of the Rings, I think because exactly that it follows that stress and release pattern, because the microcosm imitates the macrocosm, because it's there and back again, reading The Lord of the Rings feels like the successful completion of a psychological journey. And I think that's what's happened for so many readers and why Tolkien's work remains so powerful today. One of the biggest reasons that Tolkien's secondary world hangs together so well is that it had a background. It had the background of the languages, it had the background of the histories, and it had the background of the legends. In the next lecture, we're going to examine those legends in The Silmarillion and in other work that was not published during Tolkien's lifetime, but was edited by his son Christopher and published later on. You'll see that The Silmarillion, although it's a very, very difficult text, has a lot to offer to readers of The Lord of the Rings, but we'll also see that The Silmarillion does not succeed as well as The Lord of the Rings did because it lacks the crucial mediating agent of the hobbits that can bring the ancient world into contact with the modern world. The Silmarillion, on the other hand, exists completely by itself.
This ends Lecture 7.